Jake Williams is a documentarian and the creator and host of Bright Sun Films, one of the most fascinating channels on YouTube. Since 2013, he has posted over 166 in-depth, high-quality videos, garnering over 160 million views. Three main series on his channel include Bankrupt, focusing on the stories behind corporate bankruptcies, such as Kodak or Planet Hollywood, Canceled, a series about TV shows and products that have been canceled, and most notably his flagship series Abandoned, which gives viewers an inside look into buildings and other places, even a whole town that have been abandoned and left to the elements and how they got to that point. His videos are well researched, beautifully presented, dramatic, and give us a first-person look sometimes into some very creepy locations that once flourished. We learn about the history of these places, as well as their eventual decline and abandonment. Jake's recently completed his first feature-length documentary, Closed for Storm, slated for release in July 2021. It's the untold story of Six Flags New Orleans, a theme park that's been abandoned and rotting away for the past 15 years. And as a guy who absolutely loves theme parks, I'm really looking forward to talking to him about this. Hey, Jake, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
July 10th, 2012, according to YouTube at least, is when you started your channel. But it wasn't called Bright Sun Films back then, was it? Tell us a little bit about what was going on in 2012 when you first started your YouTube channel.
Yeah, it was Bright Sun Gaming at the time. I was a young person going into high school at the time, so I was very much into playing video games and doing such on the internet, and that's how it all began. But what I quickly realized is that I don't like doing that, so about 2 years later, I pivoted into what I'm doing now, and the rest is history, I guess. It's been a long road ever since I started Abandoned.
And you kind of have a similar story to other people we've talked to who were doing one thing, and then all of a sudden, right when you were about to just kind of quit, you had a hit, and you know, right then knew what direction to take your channel in.
Yeah, I had planned a video to end the channel. I was ready to go. I had sort of burned out on everything, even though I was like 16 at the time or something like that. So I was really ready to quit. And it's just within like a week or so, the first episode of my Abandoned series, which was on a Disney abandoned island, had just blown up, at least in my perspective. So it was a huge motivator. And yeah, I had shelved that ending video and still shelved, I guess, to this day. But hopefully I never have to pull that script back out.
What was it like to go through high school and have a YouTube channel? Granted, at a time that it's a thing now, and that's fine. Yeah. But in 2013, 2014, it must have been a little different. What was it like to have a YouTube channel, and what did the kids think at high school?
It was kind of like having a way for my group of friends to all come together. It was sort of like another way to hang out with your friends in high school, I guess, in a way. But I've always found myself, or I've always thought of myself, to be a bit more mature for my age. I'm still really young, and I'm talking about Pier 1 imports. Like, not many people do that, I don't think, especially when I was in high school. So I always thought the channel was a bit unique, and as it grew, I think a lot more people in my school had sort of woken up and realized that what myself and my friends had created was pretty interesting, and hopefully it's a success case since. So hopefully after high school, I'm not the lamest person going out, but pretty proud.
Do you remember what YouTubers you were watching at the time back in 2012 who kind of influenced you and got you thinking that this is maybe something that you could try?
Rooster Teeth was a big inspiration to me. They were this, at the time, I guess, a small production house in Austin. And they sort of had this community-esque, fun sketch comedy type thing that they had going. I really don't know what Rooster Teeth is doing now, but they were really big. They were a huge inspiration to me at the time. Adam the Woo, he was Disney Urbex, I guess you would call it at the time. He has also since pivoted to, I guess, more family-friendly Disney content, if you would. But yeah, he was a huge inspiration to me. Still is, really. I mean, it's he was sort of the first person on YouTube to make that sort of first person, don't take yourself too seriously, abandoned content, which, you know, even to this day, I still really think is a huge inspiration to myself. So yeah, it's sort of competing, or sort of two different genres at the time, but definitely two entities that were a huge inspiration to me.
So at the time you had, when you shot the Disney, Discovery Island, is that what it's called? That was your first?
Or Discovery Island was the first one, yeah.
The first abandoned one. Mm-hmm. And did you have any idea that that was going to become such a hit?
No, I've always said this at the very beginning, is that Abandoned was made for me because no one else made videos on this type of stuff. And I just wanted to dive deeper into the information. I remember River Country was something, because of Adam the Woo, I had taken deep inspiration for. And at the time, there was only Adam's video and some guy that was talking to a camera just listing off facts from Wikipedia. So to me, it was like, well, there's sort of this interesting void on YouTube right now that no one really talks about the deeper history and why it's like this, and you know, to dig a little deeper into something. And so I took it upon myself to make something that I would want to watch. And apparently that was successful with other people. So I'm glad that was the case. And I still look back at my videos, and I just watched the McBarge video a couple days ago. I was like, oh, that's interesting. You know, I'm glad I made this. I'm glad this exists on the internet now. So it's that was sort of the whole inspiration, I think, from the very beginning. And hopefully I've done a good job at filling that void that I was trying to create, or that I was trying to fill in the very beginning.
Do you find yourself at this point, now that you've had a fair amount of success with these types of videos, do you find yourself more moving towards what the audience wants to see, or do you still find it very important to have it be an outlet for what you find interesting?
I think as I've grown, it's meshed together. I think I'm still biased towards what I find interesting. I think a lot of people always comment they want to see me do a video on the Titanic, or a video on, I don't know, something that I'm not personally interested in talking about. I love the Titanic, but having a video from Brightson Films about the Titanic is not going to shed any new light on this topic. So I don't see any intrinsic value in it. But I think what I find most interesting and most successful is when I talk about things that I have a passion for, A, and B, things that are not necessarily talked about, like McBarge, or like the Chicago Spire. Like, who's thought of the Chicago Spire since 2008? It's it's
the Memphis Pyramid.
Fun. Yeah, it's fun to shed light on something that hasn't been talked about in a number of years. And I think, again, that's where I see myself bringing value to the table.
The Costa Concordia video, how long mm-hmm. between when that actually was a newsworthy event to the time that you managed to get? Like, what kind of window do you have when an event like that happens and you want to put together a video documenting it, putting all that work into it and making sure it isn't just timely at the sake of not being informative? So how long does that take, and how crazy is the time during when a disaster like that happens to, like, you being like, okay, I want to make a video on this, but I need to do it quickly?
Yeah, I think well, the Concordia went down in 2012, and that video came out 2017 or 2018, I believe, somewhere around there. So there was a significant time difference. When I first approached that video, though, one thing that I realized is that the media, despite its enormous coverage of it, they really didn't handle it very well, because I clearly like ships, so I have a deeper interest in naval architecture and such. So even with me, with my deeper level of knowledge, I still didn't really understand how the Concordia went down, how it sunk. So I think because of that, the media did a pretty bad job at telling this story. So I took it upon myself to sort of actually look at the NTSB report and break down how it all happened and why it happened and all that. And I think that's where I had approached it at the very beginning. And I think I succeeded with that, because that's my most viewed video on the channel. And I think there's a reason because of that. I think a lot of people find ship videos interesting. They they have a passing knowledge of the Costa Concordia, but they don't actually know the deeper details about it. So again, you know, that's where I hope to come back in and bring value to the table on those types of topics. Hopefully, people leave that video knowing a lot more than they ever would have if they hadn't watched it.
It must have been a challenging one because there was certainly a lot of deaths involved in that one. So one of the questions I wanted to ask you is, how do you kind of navigate the difference between doing an abandoned theme park versus mm-hmm. doing something where an event where people have passed away, and quite possibly the people who are watching this maybe knew those people, or regardless yeah. of that, you're just dealing with the loss of life. So you kind of have to tread differently around that. Is that something that is top of mind when you're putting that together?
Yeah, I think from the very beginning, you need to approach something with a level of respect. I see a lot of documentaries now, especially that new one about the Cecil Hotel. You know, you approach a topic that's so absurd when you're talking about another person's death that I think it becomes disrespectful, especially when you get into ghost stuff and all that. But yeah, with the Concordia, I had hoped to remove much of the humor that you could have put into it and sort of talk about just the facts and how everything happened. But then there's levels of like the Estonia, the ferry that went down in the late 90s, where 300 people or so had perished on board that ship, which is an enormous tragedy and a huge sore spot for so many people. So I think even at that point, I start to get a little nervous with even wanting to approach that, because sometimes I just don't think I'm the person to talk about something like that. I'm not the person to get into really complex human tragedy like that. So I think there is a fine line of what I should be talking about, what I shouldn't be talking about, or at least what I'm qualified, in my opinion, to approach. So yeah, everyone needs to have a little level of respect before they start diving into topics that are very, very deep.
Have you ever abandoned one of your own projects, started it, and just kind of thought this?
That would make a great video in itself, an abandoned video.
I start so many scripts and just never finish them. I have several on Thomas. I can't even remember the company, the airline that went bankrupt
Thomas
a couple
Cook?
Years ago. Yeah. Another one was Sports Authority. Yeah. That another one that I just abandoned. Yeah, there's a few that I just start because a lot of people want to see it, but then I just have no interest in doing it, or there's an issue with finding enough media for it and whatnot. So yeah, there's a bunch of scripts sitting on the cutting room floor there that may never happen.
It's interesting that your channel is diversified, and it's not just the abandoned, even mm-hmm. though clearly that's kind of your main thing, but that you do the bankrupt series, which is interesting, and the canceled series, and they all seem to perform yeah. really well. So that's a good place to be.
Yeah, it is. It's I'm very fortunate to be able to make a video on pretty much any topic that I want to and still have some interest. And I think it's because a lot of the viewers who stick around have similar interests than I do. I mean, the topics that I cover are not necessarily that vastly different from each other. Well, I guess they are if you really look at it. But I think if people are thinking like I do, and they have an interest in abandoned places or forgotten things, then there's going to be some parallels to you know, bankrupt companies. They were forgotten by you know, their shareholders and whatnot, and then the same could be extended to the ship disaster videos, where, you know, you have this liner that had gone down, and, you know, so it's I think they all connect in a vague way, but I'm glad that so many people are able to diversify their interest within my channel.
I was thinking about you and your channel when I saw this documentary on Netflix called The Last Blockbuster. Have you seen that?
Oh, I haven't yet, but I've heard it's very good.
So it kind of combines the bankrupt along with mm-hmm. abandoned. Yeah. And there's this one blockbuster that's left up in Oregon. People make pilgrimages to it.
Right. Yeah. I was just watching the trailer on that a week ago or something. I was just thinking how beautifully shot that was. Yeah. I absolutely yeah. need to watch that. Is it on Netflix?
I think it's Netflix. Yeah.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'll check it out if it is on Canadian Netflix. They're
Can any story make an interesting bankrupt or canceled video? Or ultimately, does it even kind of like supersede the interest of people who are like generally interested in these types of things, but there's just not enough oomph to it? Or it's just like, no, this is just literally the story of a company losing money and their doors closed. Yeah. And there's really not much more. Do you sometimes find trouble finding the interesting story aspect of some of these?
Yeah,
things?
I think Sports Authority is probably a great example of that, of me giving up on that video because there wasn't really much to it. Honestly, a lot of people know about Sports Authority, but I don't think anyone really cared about it. And while a lot of people want me to do it, I really don't think they actually want me to do it because the video is not going to be that interesting. So, there's, especially now too with COVID, a lot of the stories are going to end the same right now that, our store had to close in March and we were never able to reopen. So there's going to have to be a fine line that I have to walk in the next couple of years to sort of analyze how these companies went down that isn't just ending with because of COVID.
It kind of has to be for a company that's more of a beloved company, a Radio
Kmart.
Shack or Blockbuster or those kind of
things. Right. Yeah, it's if like Cisco Technologies went bankrupt, I don't think anyone would necessarily care unless you're really deep in the IT world or something.
Is it fair to say that there's an element of abandoned videos that doesn't kind of meet that same metric? I heard you speaking on another podcast and you were talking about, I think you released an episode about a Walmart store and you were just surprised that like an abandoned Walmart store, but I get an abandoned theme park, that's extravagant and amazing and whatever, but an abandoned Walmart is essentially just a big box full of empty shelves. But there's something, what is it about just abandoned? Like, is it because there's this thought of like, wow, that's worth a whole bunch of money and people just left, like the solution to this was literally just leaving it there to like go away.
Right. I mean, especially when I go visit places, it's interesting to see how views work, what people gravitate towards, because proper people, who I believe are the gold standard of exploration on YouTube, they do a lot of factory stuff, a lot of industrial spaces, which are really interesting to look at. But then you see something like that Walmart video or the Kmart video get hundreds of thousands, millions of views. And it's like, why does this get more views than something that's like Art Deco, beautifully industrial, abandoned? And I think it's truly because so many people have visit these types of places, a Days Inn or a Walmart or a Kmart, on a day-to-day basis. And then when you see it in such this visceral, abandoned, unbelievable state, it is, it's unbelievable. It's difficult to wrap your head around how something that you can visit every day or something that you see on the highway in pristine condition turn into something like this. And that's what I personally really love. I love seeing like Days Inns that have vines growing through their hotel rooms or something. It's such an incredible visual for me. So it's that's sort of the stuff that I always have found more interest in too.
I asked the question because I was absolutely fascinated by the banalness of it all.
Right.
And I think there is that relatability. Like, I mean, if I've never seen a fancy, you know, the Disney park in Europe or whatever it is. So seeing it abandoned, I guess I really, whatever. But you're very much right. I've been in a Walmart recently and I know what it looks like with the lights on and shelves full.
Yeah.
But like, there's something so surreal and different about exploring the space when there's maybe an also like a voyeurness to it, like where it's like it feels like I shouldn't be doing this, which kind of leads me to my next question, which is maybe a question you get a lot. What are the legalities surrounding going into somewhere and filming which is abandoned?
Well, it technically is trespassing, but a lot of these places are in limbo, or they're owned by mega corporations that obviously are not caring for their property. I think the rule we've always gone by, and everyone who's in this urbex community will go by, is that as long as you're not, at least from my experience at least, as long as you're not breaking things, as long as you're not being disrespectful to the property, and that's a huge discerning factor that a lot of people don't necessarily abide by, but as long as you're being respectful to a property, you're usually not going to get in trouble. So I've always found that to be true. And that's something that I'm always going to live by. And there's always a level of, if you're on a government property or something, then you probably shouldn't be extending past what you think is safe enough for you. That's another thing too. It's your safety factor, whether it's legality wise or actual, you know, this building's going to collapse on top of you or something. So it is a bit of a fine line again, but it's, I think if you play it by ear and you actually use common sense, that you'll probably be fine at the end of the day.
I think one of the things I like about the videos where you go exploring these buildings is the kind of first person shooter aspect of it, where you're just walking with the camera and I feel like I'm in there with you, especially when you've got the light on the camera. Right. And so you're only illuminating these small areas. And it reminds me of like found footage film or something. I'm like, oh my God, what's around the next corner? And then you hear the sounds and it's really well done.
Yeah. It's a huge, like, it's almost cinematic in a way. You know, I just thinking back to that Kmart video, which we had filmed at night, and there's like fireworks going off in the background. There's a thunderstorm approaching. We're in this deplorable abandoned Kmart building with the roof half collapsed. I mean, can you get any more cinematic than that? That is so
it's
cool.
Scary.
And then, like you said, you have the one light only illuminating what's in front of you. Yeah, it's terrifying. And it's like, it's such an insane visual to even think of.
And do you think that's what the fascination with abandoned buildings is? Why people love this? Why abandoned places?
I think with especially Americans, it's a lot of nostalgia behind what you're looking at. Everyone has a passing knowledge, usually at least, of what I go and explore. So a lot of people are curious. For me, I've always said it's like the monetary side of things. I'm always fascinated how things are abandoned, because we're in such a wasteful society where, you know, land is so valuable at this point, but we have so many abandoned buildings that are just going to be torn down, especially in Canada too, where I had done a video recently on an abandoned mansion that was going to be torn down by developers. And like, this home is still almost completely intact. I mean, they're $2 million plus home with an infinity pool and everything. It's just going to be torn down by developers. So it's, I think it's the wastefulness of our society that, at least I find interesting. And I think extends to a lot of other people. Like I said, the nostalgia and, just that curiosity, you know, everyone sees an abandoned building on the side of the road, but not many people actually go into it, because why would you? But, I think we're some of the few people that actually do go inside and give an interesting and unique look into what something like this looks like.
And that was an amazing video. Being from Toronto, it was amazing to, it was great to
see. Oh, I didn't know you're from Toronto.
Yeah, Jack. Yeah, really? Yeah. Just north of Toronto. So going through and seeing some of the places, which I actually recognize, was amazing. However, during that video, you ran into someone who was living or squatting or whatever in one of the houses. How often does that come about? How often do you run into people actually living or staying in the spaces that you're in, or is that a bit of a rarity?
It is actually a bit of a rarity. I think it depends on the location of it. A lot of the places that we go to are usually in the middle of nowhere, sort of. You see a lot of remnants of people who are squatting there at one point, but rarely do we ever actually encounter someone that's in there. Also, another thing too is that we usually explore in the summertime, so there's a lot less likelihood of someone actually going to be inside a building during the warm months. So in the winter, it's probably a different story. Yeah, it is a bit of a rarity. One of the only instances that I can think of, other than that one time we were exploring in Toronto, was in Detroit at the abandoned motel. I think that was in 2016 or something. And it's incredibly depressing to go into these buildings. You need a respirator. You'll get sick if you're in there for more than a couple hours. But, you know, we came across this couple that were just sleeping in one of the motel rooms, and it's unbelievably sad. And it's such a great example of how Detroit specifically is in such a terrible condition right now. So, yeah, it's rare, but when it happens, it's very, very depressing to come across. It sort of degrades everyone's mood, I think, once we do find someone. But we've only had good experiences with people, so that's been a good sign.
You ever gotten in any trouble? Had any really scary close calls?
Honestly, for all of our time, like I said, I'm very careful about what we do and how we do it. So, we've never gotten in trouble. We've never had a bad situation per se. The only time we've ever really been in a bit of danger is when we were in Pahokee, Florida, and we were just walking around the town and someone threatened us with a hatchet. So that was it. But we weren't even exploring an abandoned building. We were just walking around the town.
That's just regular danger.
Right. That's just regular Florida.
Florida man.
I will preface this question by saying I do not believe in ghosts, but were there any points where you were just truly spooked, like really, really spooked because something happened or just, you know, a moment where you got caught up in the darkness of the building you were in?
Not really. I also, to preface this, I don't believe in ghosts as well. We've never had a scary experience until just, I think, 2 months ago. We were exploring, we were in Toronto for a different reason, but it was about 2 a.m. and the place that we wanted to get into wasn't working out. So we had actually gone to the third mansion that we filmed in the Toronto mansion, Abandoned Mansions video, just to check up on it, just to see how it's doing, because we heard it was vandalized a bit more since my video came out. So we went there and we just walked around the building and we went to the roof in an area that we didn't get to go to in the first time we explored it. And in there was this little cubby in the attic, and some other kids or someone else had pulled something out of it, a little box, and it had a bunch of dolls in it and this strange writing on it. I posted this on my Twitter and we couldn't discern what this meant. It freaked us out a little bit. It's 2 a.m., remember, in this abandoned mansion. This girl talking about how she doesn't want her dolls to get hurt or something. Freaky stuff. So we're walking back down the stairs just to leave. Nothing too terrifying at this point. As we're walking down the stairs in this pitch black house, we hear two different loud bangs across the other side of the building. And it wasn't windy that day. It couldn't have been an animal. So we didn't know what was going on. So that freaked us out quite a bit. And we had just rushed out of the building. So that's probably the only time that I've actually been legitimately freaked out about what happened inside an abandoned building that I couldn't explain, at least.
Have you been working with the same group of people for all this time?
Yeah. Dan Bell and I have been friends since early 2016, and Brennan Evangelista from Uncharted Travel, him and I have been friends since about 2015 at this point. So we've been, they're the only people I go exploring with. Brennan's my most trusted ally and a good friend of mine. So yeah, it's and he's local too, which is nice. Not many explorers in Canada, as it turns out.
We don't have the nice weather. No one wants to go exploring in the winter.
Yeah. Also, we don't have any place to go exploring in Canada. Everything in Canada gets torn down very quickly.
Do you have a dream place that you would love to explore, given time and money and travel?
A lot of the dream places I would have loved to have gone to are gone now. I think a dream place would be Discovery Island, but that's never going to happen. I think, honestly, otherwise would be Six Flags New Orleans, and I can say confidently, we did it.
Yeah, man, I am really looking forward to that documentary. And by the way, the trailer that you made for that is spectacular.
Yeah, thank you very much. I very much appreciate it.
It reminds me of the... I don't know if you ever watched Phineas and Ferb show cartoon. They had the old abandoned amusement park. It was an amusement park that was themed as an old abandoned amusement
awesome.
Park, and then it became abandoned.
Steve drawing parallels from Closer Storm to Phineas and Ferb.
Right, I know. But there's something very creepy about amusement parks that are abandoned. Yeah. Why is that?
Well, I think that draws into the nostalgia part again, that theme parks are like the most joyous place that you could probably think of in at least the United States. So seeing one that's desolate and, you know, water moccasins are slithering across the midway, it's freaky to see that. It's something that you really don't normally see. And Six Flags represents probably... one of the definitely the largest, but one of the only abandoned theme parks in the entire world. It's very rare for a theme park to become abandoned. So the history of Six Flags makes it even more interesting because obviously a series of events had to have led to something this unprecedented happening. So that's what the film tries to discern, at least.
And that park's been abandoned for like 15 years now or something?
Yeah, going on 16 years. So ever since Katrina, which was 2005.
Is this your first film?
First feature film. I don't know if we would call my YouTube work films, but yeah, this is feature length, professionally distributed, professionally done. So this is my directorial debut, I guess you would call it.
That's fantastic.
What has the experience been like? What has been some of the biggest differences between the professional stuff, which you put on YouTube, by the way? Don't undersell that really. YouTube stuff. That's what got you here, young man.
I appreciate it, yes.
How has the experience differed?
I think if I were to use one word, it would be hell. this has been a long, arduous process. Who knew making a movie was so hard? I mean, jeez. No, I started this project in early 2019. So it's been a long ride. It's self-funded, so that just makes it even more arduous. But it's a long road from that point. A lot of permits, a lot of money, got to hire a crew. All things I'm learning for the first time. I've had no professional training, or I haven't gone to school for film. So a lot of this has been an enormous learning experience for me. And I guess the point of Closer Storm is sort of the apotheosis of everything that I've been making on YouTube, what all of this has been leading to, something that I wanted to bring to the next level. And Closer Storm is going to represent that, and it's also going to open the next phase of my career and my life. And yeah, we're already working on the next big thing, but so Closer Storm, you know, it's been the culmination of 10 years on YouTube. So it really is, you know, my baby.
Did you try to stylize it in the same way that you stylize a YouTube video? As in, did you try to make it so therefore it looked like a feature film coming from someone with the discipline of making YouTube videos and incorporating them? Because clearly there's a relatability. You're in a place where you need to do voiceover work for your videos, right? But you can't sound like Morgan Freeman, or else it's just way too polished and it just doesn't fit that.
Yeah.
So did you walk that line between making a polished piece, which looked different maybe than the YouTube videos, but still harkened back to some of the things which made people take notice of you in the first
place?
Yeah,
the discipline aspect is a really good way to put it, because I made an intentional decision to keep my voiceover for it, since it is sort of an extension of the YouTube channel itself. So that remains in place. There's a segment in the film that that is sort of that first-person exploration stuff through some of the lesser-known areas of the park. I think, you know, it shed some light on, literally, shed some light on those areas. So there is many aspects of it that we intentionally tried to keep it. I don't know if you'd call it amateurish, but it more towards
relatable.
More relatable, yeah, more relatable and familiar to the audience. So that was definitely an intentional decision. I think we achieved a good balance between having it professional with these, you know, really good looking interviews, but also keeping the stuff that's familiar with the channel.
Was it difficult to line up the interviews?
Yes, very difficult. So Six Flags New Orleans Jazzland closed obviously in 2005 with Katrina. So scanning through LinkedIn, trying to find people who worked at Six Flags New Orleans, a regional small park, probably a staff of maybe 150, 200 people from 2005, has been extremely, extremely difficult. We had, again, self-funded, so timelines were very tight. We were in New Orleans ready to film people on live location. And we had two people pull out at the very last second, a day before we were supposed to go shoot them. Yeah, so we were down to the wire on some things. Well, thank God it came out all right. But yeah, I was very nervous for a little bit that we weren't going to get what we wanted, especially from the perspectives, since, yeah, finding people were very difficult, especially people who are still in the theme park industry that have no interest in talking about this disaster and this the legal challenges thereafter. So yeah, it was it was rough. Very rough.
Is the Six Flags company involved in this at all, or did you have to get them involved in any way?
Yeah, no involvement from Six Flags. Honestly, the involvement of Six Flags in the story is rather small. Six Flags came into the picture in 2003, I believe. And of course, they abandoned the park in 2005. So really, really, they're a small point in the picture, even though the park is, in its last form at least, called Six Flags New Orleans. Yeah.
What about your documentary process? Is this something that you write a bit of a script before you shoot anything, or do you try to just shoot all the interviews, ask all the questions, and then you go mm-hmm. back and script it?
Yeah, it was with something like this that has not much of a complete story already known, it's hard to figure out where the story is going to go. Because at the end of the day, we really sort of took a bit of a different direction, and we followed the journey of one particular person towards the end of the film that is trying to develop the park, something we had no idea that this was ever going to turn out to be, because she had been fighting with the city to allow her to develop the park. And we finally get to her apex, her arc of the story, where we'll see at the end of the film. But it's it took us places that we didn't think we were going to go, and it made us shed light on things that that we didn't even really think of an issue, like the homes that are surrounding the park. You know, those, their home value has decreased since 2005. You know, it's some of the only housing in America that's hasn't appreciated since the crash of 2008. So it's an interesting issue for a lot of the people, and especially the region of New Orleans East, which is a statistically poorer area in New Orleans, and they have to deal with this huge abandoned theme park on their land.
So you go and make a video mm-hmm. about the RMS Queen yes. Mary. You do all of the things that you need to do to make that video. It's 22 minutes right. long. You put it on your YouTube channel, which has a million subscribers, and you get 619,000 views in the first 4 days.
Pretty good.
Tell us about what it's like to get eyes on a movie.
Yeah, it's... hopefully we get the same amount of eyes, but so we've signed a deal with Gravitas Ventures, which was a huge plus for us. We really didn't have a great festival run because of the pandemic. Again, I picked a hell of a year to make a movie, right?
Was it supposed to open last year?
I wanted to have it distributed by early 2020. That wasn't going to happen, but so the festival run, you know, really delayed things, and it brought everything down. But thankfully, our sales agency were able to secure a deal with Gravitas. And, well, I guess I could announce it here that Closer Storm is going to be coming out July 6th, 2021. So this is the first time.
That is a Chad and Steve Have a Podcast exclusive, everyone.
Exclusive release date. Yeah, so that's going to be our wide release from Gravitas on all VOD platforms. And then, you know, 6 to 9 months after that, hopefully some streaming platforms. But that'll be the first phase of our release. And, you know, obviously a lot of marketing and promotion from the YouTube channel. And I think it'll be successful. A lot of people are anticipating this film, and they have been for the past almost 3 years. So, yeah, hopefully there's enough pimped up hype for it.
I know you're a thumbnail guy.
Yeah.
So my question is, when it came to do the poster for the movie, were you like, I got this? Or was it, I'll find out what other people think?
I thought I did. I'm not a graphic designer, and I think our first phase of the poster proves that, because it's not very great. I really like the sign of the park that says Closed for Storm on it, because obviously that's where the name of the film comes from.
And it had like missing letters too.
Right, it has missing
letters. It
looks
so wonderfully dilapidated.
Right, yeah. It's all torn up. So I thought that's such a great icon. That's how our poster was for a little bit of the film. But once we partnered up with our sales agency, they had their designers take a look at it, and we had asked them if they could make something a little more moody, something a little darker, and you know, a little something that fits the theme of this, maybe perhaps a little more than a bright sign that I'm so used to making on YouTube thumbnails. So they crafted this, and I mean, it's this beautiful. Is just so much better than anything I could have come up with. So I looked at the PSD file, the Photoshop file, and there's about 1,100 assets in this thing. I was like, oh my God, I can't even imagine building something like this in Photoshop. So yeah, I'm glad we have other talented people in this.
How much time does it take to put together a regular old YouTube thumbnail, and how many different versions, and do you A/B test them? Or, I mean, a thumbnail is what you got. You have a 25-minute video, which took you an enormous amount of time to make, and you're left with, you know, if the thumbnail is going to sell it or not.
Right. It's I like to keep things really, really simple, and I love having bold text that's clearly visible. So some things just work, like the Chicago Spire. You have the skyline, so you have a lot of space in the sky for some text. But other things, like right now, I'm doing the Hard Rock theme park in Myrtle Beach, and that's proven to be a bit of a challenge because there isn't really much of a landmark in it that's discernible. So I'm really going back and forth on what I'm going to do for that thumbnail. If I'm going to use the front gate or something like that, we'll have to see. But yeah, there's some tough ones, especially with like places like Centralia that don't really have that great of pictures in the first place. That was the
that's the town that burned up underneath,
right? Exactly, in Pennsylvania. Yeah, it's that place was sort of difficult, and that thumbnail wasn't that great, and I don't think the video did that well, if I'm remembering correctly. So thumbnails are everything. Yeah.
That was an interesting video. I didn't know the story behind that at all, and it's kind of
sad. It's insane, isn't it?
It is. Isn't it crazy? This like whole town is on fire underneath the town. There's like coal mines, like a network of coal mines that are all on fire. I guess
still burning to this day.
Yeah, it's amazing. When you started this documentary, did you know that you were going to be building it into such a big thing with all of the people that you've hired for it and assembling that team?
Yeah, it's funny. I was planning on filming this whole thing with a Sony. I was going to make this an exploration video because I had figured out from a friend of mine that the city does in fact grant permits to just about everyone that's willing to pay for it. So I thought, oh, well, this will be cool. I'll make a really nice quality YouTube video with this. I'll make something a little more high quality. And then my composer friend of mine who's in Los Angeles, he's like, well, no, we got to take this to the next level. I could hook you up with a post producer. We could start building this into something really big. And then over like a span of a couple months, it turned into something that was like $70,000 to do this whole thing. I was like, how did this happen? Why are we hiring like 50 people now? So, it sort of ballooned way out of control, and, it's something way bigger than I ever thought it was going to be. Yeah. By the end, we were shooting with red cameras. I mean, it's like such a huge difference than what I thought it was going to be. But, you know, I'm glad it was. I'm glad we did go that path because otherwise it would have been all for nothing, I think. And I don't think we would be at the next step of my career with our next big project, too. So, yeah.
Was there one part about the walking through the theme park that you found to be the most startling?
So one of the sections that I mentioned in the film is going to be the exploration, particularly in places that I don't think many people had ever gone to. And one of those is the head offices, the administration offices in the front of the park near the main entrance. And everything in there, I'm not kidding, everything is left as it was since 2005. So you walk into these buildings with frogs hopping around on the floor and and grass growing through the carpet, and the water lines are still clearly visible through on the walls, and these monitors, the computers are like half folded over on the desks that have just collapsed, and you see the water line on the monitors of the computers, and you see the calendar of August 2005. It is the most surreal place I have ever been in my entire life. It was unbelievable. Probably about 130 degrees inside that building at night with humidity. But it was shocking to see. I mean, you're walking into Katrina. You know, you're walking into a couple days after the water had receded after Hurricane Katrina. You're living in a part of history that is often forgotten about in America. So seeing that firsthand, as someone who's young and that I have no recollection of Katrina, and seeing it firsthand, it's like walking through a museum. It's like probably the creepiest place I have ever been in my entire life. So I hope we captured that well. I think we do capture that well in the film. And when you guys watch it, hopefully you watch it.
I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah, totally. It's a fascinating exploration for sure.
So completely self-funded. Congratulations.
Thank you. Yes.
Such a massive accomplishment, yeah. Not only to like get to the point where you can actually do such a bucket list thing, but to be able to fund it yourself. So a little bit of a dive into your financials. That's sure. too many specifics, but give us a breakdown of how, at least your YouTube channel, I know you have a Patreon, clearly you do ads. Are CPMs in your space dictated or based upon them being abandoned videos, or is it dependent upon the subject matter? So if you're doing a Target, do you notice fluctuations in your CPMs depending on the subject of the video?
Yeah, it's interesting actually. Like I'll look at my videos. I'll look at my revenue from the videos, and you'll see something like, I don't know, the Chicago Spire. It makes a good amount of money. And then you see other videos that have hundreds of thousands of views more than that video within the month, like the Costa Concordia, get maybe half of that revenue. So it's interesting to see how oftentimes when you talk about tragedies, when you talk about darker subjects, despite you getting more views, it's actually less money, which has always been fascinating. And then, situations like the adpocalypse in 2017 and the COVID crisis in early 2020, revenue had dropped off significantly. And it was pretty worrying there for a second for me, actually. Pretty severe, probably about 20% of what I normally make on YouTube during the March, April, May area of 2020. So it was pretty rough. But anyway, to answer your question, yeah, there some videos, depending on their subject matter, are for some reason just going to do worse than others. I honestly have no idea, and I think a lot of other creators don't, because it's the YouTube overlords. Their algorithm decides what's going to do well and what isn't, both in views and money.
There's secrets that we just should not know.
Exactly.
But outside of that, you also do merch. You've found other ways to kind of offset that, and yeah, sponsored work. So what does sponsored work look like now, actually, versus even just a few years ago when it was certainly more prevalent and available?
So thankfully now I'm with a company called Standard. They're partnered with Nebula and CuriosityStream. So they're currently the people I'm working with right now to secure sponsorships. I'll be honest, it's been a little harder. Not a lot of brands are interested in working on, working with me at least, on abandoned stories and whatnot. That they're, I think, probably a little more biased towards more family centered content, even though my content isn't necessarily explicit or anything. But sponsorships have been a good source. I've been doing a lot more unique merchandise lately. Just with the Queen Mary video, I had commissioned special posters for some of the ships that I talked about in my videos. Those have been a huge success, way under anticipated how many people would actually be interested in that. So I've been doing interesting stuff like that. My good friend and designer, Josh Bailey, he actually works at Rooster Teeth right now, and he designs a lot of the stuff for my videos and for the merch drops that I do. So I think, as I continue to do more unique stuff like that, I'll hopefully be able to phase out, the t-shirts and all that one day, since I don't necessarily like doing stuff like that. I would prefer to have unique stuff that people can take away from my channel and my videos.
I stayed at the Queen Mary a couple of years ago.
Oh, did you really? Yeah. What did you think, Steve?
I think that it was dilapidated. It was like, it was not really the best hotel experience. But, and a lot of the places of the ship are just closed off, so you really can't see a
right.
lot. The swimming pool was kind of creepy because it's all dark and it's this real cavernous looking swimming pool. But
can I ask you how much you paid for a night there?
I don't remember. It was fairly reasonable, I guess, for the going rate of what a hotel would be. I mean, Long Beach is it's a very industrial town.
Right.
And that place is way outside of anything. So you really got to make it kind of a destination to go there. It's an interesting thing to see.
And that's one of the issues with it.
Yeah. And I didn't know anything about what you were talking about. And I didn't know it was having all of these problems. I guess looking back on it, I could kind of see, that's probably evident that they're having some sort of ownership problems. And it's just sad to see that.
Right. Yeah. It seems like a depressing area. And for such an iconic ship, it's really not getting the treatment it deserves right now. Yeah. And it's not looking good for it right now.
Yeah. I love learning about these things on your channel. Just things like the Memphis pyramid.
Yeah.
I didn't know. What a weird thing.
Right,
like one of the world's largest pyramids in areas in
Memphis. That's a Bass Pro Shop in Memphis, Tennessee.
It's a Bass Pro Shop. That's the funniest thing. And it's like a theme park, sort of, I guess. It's like this destination sporting goods store.
Yeah. With a hotel inside it and an observation deck with a glass elevator that goes to the apex.
Right.
Have you ever thought of doing an abandoned video on abandoned YouTube channels?
Oh.
Oh, yeah. People have been asking for that. I don't know if I'm willing to do that. I feel like that's going to stir up controversy or something.
But views. Lots of views from it.
You need the drama. Well, your channel's doing pretty well. Hey, you just got 1 million subscribers recently.
Yeah.
Congratulations on that. Have you gotten the plaque yet?
I haven't. You know what? It's funny. It's not funny. I'm quite depressed about this. We had reached 1 million subscribers. The first time my channel has ever received a strike, a copyright strike. So because of that, if your channel is not in good standing, you can't receive a play button. So for the first time in my 10 years, I got a strike, and it just so happened to be when I crossed 1 million subscribers. So I'm currently in talking to people in YouTube help that will hopefully give me my play button, but it's not looking good right now, I'll be honest.
What was the strike on? Was it music?
It was for the SS America video. I believe it was someone who was just, or it was the website that I had actually talked about who had explored it. I guess they weren't very happy with their use in my video, so they got a little angry and they took it to the next level and gave me a strike and removed the video. So,
wow.
What are you gonna do?
Have you had any other demonetization issues with your content? Do you ever run into
issues? Not really. I've been pretty fortunate in my content. Every once in a while, there will be someone that'll be a bit angry that I accidentally used their video without permission or something. Other than that, I haven't had many issues other than music, because even though you license music properly or you get proper permission, there's always going to be Universal Music Group's always going to come after you for something. So, yeah, it's never safe in the music space on copyright.
And fair use is such muddy waters. It's really hard to understand. And you have people claiming fair use, but not fully understanding how much context or how much of a clip you can use or what actually classifies for fair use. So without getting into a huge thing, could you just briefly touch on like what you do to make sure that you're safe with the clips that you use, especially because you use a lot of just other YouTuber clips? So what's kind of the etiquette?
Just for instance, in the newest video that I'm doing, the Hard Rock Park, lots of media in that video, lots of different pictures and especially video in that. So what I first do is I try and reach out to every single video creator that I could find that has their contact listed. Because sometimes these videos are posted, especially with something like this that was from 2008, a lot of these people post these videos from 2008 and then their channel hasn't uploaded since, or, you know, it's a void channel or whatever. So it's difficult to reach out to those people, but everyone that I can, I first do ask for permission. Same with photos, especially people on Flickr. A lot of them have contacts on there. And then some people are going to be a little more protective of their images. So the thumbnail of that video that I'm working on right now, I actually licensed it from a gentleman who went there after the park was abandoned. So there's always a fine line. I also have a deal with Getty Images right now, which has been a huge help. A lot of the Queen Mary images that came from that video are from Getty. And they're just as good because it's not like stock video. It's actual great quality videos. Or if I want to take it to the actual stream, like with the Queen Mary, I just sent my composer for Closer Storm, who lives in Los Angeles. I told him to just go down to the Queen Mary and shoot some B-roll for me. And that's nice. A lot of the B-roll in that video is from Matt, who did that for me. So, yeah, it's always a mix. I either try and go there myself to get video, or I get someone else to do it, or, you know, reach out for permission and try and get it. But, you know, sometimes that doesn't happen. And, I'm really not sure what the legality aspect would be if you can claim it as, educational fair use. I'm sure you could in some respect, but no one's going to take that to court anyway. I don't think so. You know, I try being respectful as possible to the video creators who I'm not able to reach out to or whatever. So, yeah.
What is next for Jake Williams and Bright Sun Films?
All right. So I'm an NDA right now, so I can't talk about it in full. But Closer Storm's coming out July. That's
July 6th. It's on
July
6th.
Right. July 6th. The next big thing is a documentary miniseries that I want to do on I'll say this in the most vague way possible, a familiar maritime disaster.
Oh.
So that's what I'll say it on. Well, we're currently partnered with a large company out of Los Angeles who's going to help us develop the idea and then shop it out to hopefully a larger network. And our timeline's looking... Hopefully we get something moving by summer. Be even greater if we got something finished by early next year. Pre-production could start as soon as November. So that's sort of the next big thing. We're looking for a much larger budget. We're looking for something that isn't going to be self-funded by me, thank God. that's the next big thing for me. That's you know, everyone familiar with Closer to Storm, I think, is going to very much like what we have. Anyone familiar with my channel is, I think, going to very much like what we have next.
That's fantastic. You've got the documentary filmmaking bug now, don't you?
Right, exactly.
To learn more about the fascinating world of abandoned, canceled, and bankrupted places and things, be sure to subscribe to Bright Sun Films on YouTube. And to learn more about the fascinating world of creators like Jake, visit chadandsteve.com for more episodes of Chad and Steve Have a Podcast. Want to support the show? Why not listen to another episode? Or better yet, head over to Apple Podcasts and leave a review and a rating. It's quick, easy, and free for you, and it really helps this little show stand out in a sea of podcasts. Thanks for listening, everyone.